From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President-elect Joe Biden is addressing the nation for the second straight day today. This time, he's talking about the future of the Affordable Care Act, which is before the Supreme Court today. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is still pressing its case without evidence that the election isn't over. Attorney General Bill Barr sent a memo last night authorizing the Justice Department to look into Trump's baseless voter fraud claims. And the DOJ official in charge of the Voting Crimes Division resigned in protest. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now. And Tam, tell us more about this memo. Barr didn't say there was voter fraud, just that he authorized investigators to look into substantial allegations. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so there were a lot of ifs and other conditionals in the statement that he put out. He says investigations may be conducted if there are clear and apparently credible allegations of irregularities that, if true, could potentially impact the outcome of a federal election in an individual state. Which is to say that he isn't saying that those conditions exist. And he is specifically saying that frivolous or minor allegations should not be investigated before certification of the results.
Well, it was enough to upset some top-ranking officials at the Department of Justice. Richard Pilger, the DOJ official who oversees election crimes, resigned. How significant is that?
He sent an email to colleagues saying that Barr's memo abrogates a 40-year-old policy, and he says, having familiarized himself with the new policy and its ramifications, he felt that he had to step aside.
Wow. All right. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday joined other Republicans who said that the president has every right to explore and exhaust his legal challenges to get his day in court. Most of the lawsuits, though, Tam, contesting the election counts and other issues have already failed in the courts. Just give us a timeline here. What are we looking at? How long could this process take?
Yeah, most of the lawsuits, and they keep bringing new ones, but most of them haven't even survived their first contact with the U.S. justice system. How long could this go on? It's not clear how long it will truly be sustainable for the president to hold out as more votes are counted. Joe Biden's lead in several of these key states is getting larger. In Arizona, it's getting smaller, but in Pennsylvania, it's getting much larger. And, you know, what's happening here is that Republicans in Congress seem to be indulging President Trump's search for fraud, allowing him to try to exhaust all of his legal options. I mean, potentially it could go until the election is certified, but that seems somewhat unlikely. And in addition to Republicans in Congress, though, who mostly haven't congratulated President-elect Biden, you now have world leaders who are allies of President Trump. You have Boris Johnson tweeting out that he just spoke to and congratulated Joe Biden on his election, and he looks forward to working with him. So you're starting to see the president's allies around the world come and call Joe Biden.
Yeah, the momentum shifting away from President Trump. Now, what about this Republican infighting in Georgia? Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue calling on Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to step down. They're citing election irregularities, again, without any evidence. And the Secretary of State, also a Republican, Brad Raffensperger, forcefully rejected these claims. He's saying they're just upset that they're stuck in a runoff with Democrats. But this is a remarkable example of where the country is right now with this election.
But you are also pointing out something very important there, which is that both of these senators have runoffs in early January. They are campaigning for office, showing that they are still very supportive of President Trump and his position, so much so that they would call for a Republican Secretary of State in their state to resign because he conducted an election that has apparently no major problems. That is just an indication that President Trump, although he did not win, maintains an outsized role in his party. I mean, the other evidence is that most Republican senators who served with Joe Biden when he was in the Senate haven't congratulated him, at least publicly.
Yeah, all of this really is holding up the presidential transition. Biden isn't getting the usual daily presidential briefings that a president-elect normally would. His staff isn't getting access to classified materials. How much could that hamper Joe Biden in the early days of his new administration?
Well, his team is raising alarms. Transition officials say that they are looking at multiple avenues to convince the General Services Administration agency to ascertain that he is, in fact, president-elect so that he can gain access to the resources and intelligence and all of the other things that come with a transition. Interestingly, Republican Senator Marco Rubio told reporters yesterday he thinks transition is important and letting Biden get started wouldn't hurt the president's legal chances, he says.
That's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome.
Well, yesterday we spoke with a Republican lawmaker. Today, Democratic Congressman Adam Smith is here. He's chair of the House Armed Services Committee representing Washington's 9th District. Congressman, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. Appreciate the chance.
And because of your position on the Armed Services Committee, I'd like to start with yesterday's news that President Trump terminated, is the word he used in a tweet, his Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Esper disagreed with the president back in June. Esper did not want active duty military sent to control protests. We know the president was furious about that. This may be payback. But the president elevated Christopher Miller, who's director of the National Counterterrorism Center, to acting secretary. We're reading that's raising alarms. Your thoughts about that elevation?
Well, three quick things about it. I mean, first of all, it's a dangerous thing to do during the transition to replace the Secretary of Defense. I mean, a transition is a moment of potential instability. Second, it certainly seems that the president did this out of spite. I mean, if he really wanted a Secretary of Defense that he felt was more in keeping with what he wanted to do, well, he could have done it before this. He waited till after the election because he didn't want the political damage, but he did want to lash out. And then lastly, the question is, does this mean that there's going to be more disruptions during the transition period? What else could Trump do to place our government in a vulnerable position?
Well, Congressman, you say it appears to have been done out of spite, but that might be the least of the problematic reasons. Democratic Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin told the New York Times a president would fire a defense secretary without so little time if that secretary was incompetent, which she says isn't true, or for vindictiveness, which you've implied, or because the president wants to take actions that he believes his Secretary of Defense would refuse, that being Esper. And there is concern that Christopher Miller, while very competent, is in over his head now as acting secretary. Are you also concerned that President Trump might lash out in the coming weeks, say, at Iran?
Yeah. Well, I'm concerned about a lot of things he would do, but that's absolutely the correct interpretation. I mean, did he just do it out of spite, or does he have bigger plans? It's worth doing oversight and making sure that that doesn't happen. I will say that I did speak to Acting Secretary Miller yesterday, and he sounds like a solid guy who wants to do the job right. Now, he is clearly in over his head, but there are worse people that Trump could have picked at this point.
Well, meanwhile, Congressman, what should Democrats do? The president is refusing to concede the election. We have Attorney General Barr authorizing prosecutors to pursue any substantial allegations of voting irregularities. We know that every judge so far has thrown out any complaints. There does not seem to be any evidence. But there's, you know, no way for Democrats to move forward. Should President-elect Joe Biden, should he do as reportedly he's considering and take some sort of legal action against the sitting administration?
Yeah, you can go one way or the other on the legal action issue. I'll leave that to President-elect Biden and his team. I mean, do you really want to get into that fight? What's the likely outcome? Lawyers need to analyze that, who know a lot more about that than I do. But in the short term, we need to do what President-elect Biden is doing. He announced yesterday his coronavirus task force. He needs to do the transition, you know, and be ready to be president on January 20th. And he is doing that. The second thing that I would urge not just Democrats, but Americans to do is push back against this. Yes, it is completely insane for the president to be challenging this election. It's equally insane for Mitch McConnell and others to give aid and comfort to that. There's no question of the outcome here.
You know, you say push back. How? And also, do you think that Attorney General Barr and Mitch McConnell are both doing what they're doing to drive Republican voters to the polls in Georgia for the runoff elections for the Senate seats, or maybe to set the stage that those votes may be fraudulent? And if this is just political, how do Democrats offset that?
Look, you got to push back on the message war. That means social media. That means going everywhere and saying, understand America. There is nothing to contest in this election. Yeah, I mean, sure, you can say the president can pursue his legal rights. He has no legal rights in this instance because there's no question about the election. This is not Florida in 2000, where you had a difference of a few hundred votes with all kinds of ballots being contested. The outcome of this election is not in doubt. So for McConnell and those people to support this is completely wrong, and we need to make that case. And as far as why they're doing this, I think you're right. They're afraid of the president. They're afraid of his supporters. This is electoral politics that Mitch McConnell and others are playing, but they're playing it to the destruction of our Constitution. Elections are the bedrock of what we do in a representative democracy, and Mitch McConnell is calling into question those elections. He is basically challenging the very Constitution of this country. It is incredibly destructive, and we've got to fight him every step of the way on it.
Democratic Congressman Adam Smith of Washington, Chair of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, Chair, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance.
And so what happens now to President Trump? There's no evidence that current claims of voter fraud will change the outcome of this election. And by all accounts, this man who was surprised to find he won the last election has grown accustomed to the trappings of office. At a Georgia rally in October, he asked the crowd, what would he possibly do if he were to lose?
Running against the worst candidate in the history of presidential politics puts pressure on me. Could you imagine if I lose my whole life? What am I going to do? I'm going to say, I lost to the worst candidate in the history of politics. I'm not going to feel so good. Maybe I'll have to leave the country. I don't know.
Is the president actually considering that? And if he is it because he realizes when he's no longer president, he's no longer immune from prosecution? That's one of the questions raised in the most recent issue of The New Yorker, written before Joe Biden was declared president-elect. Jane Mayer writes, Trump has famously survived one impeachment, two divorces, six bankruptcies, 26 accusations of sexual misconduct, and an estimated 4,000 lawsuits. Few people have evaded consequences more cunningly. That run of good luck may well end, perhaps brutally, if he loses to Joe Biden. Well, he has. So withered Trump. Jane Mayer is chief Washington correspondent at The New Yorker. She spoke to many people close to the president and legal scholars and historians for her report, Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose, Gaming the Endgame. And she joins us from Washington, D.C. Jane, welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Well, and you begin with a dramatic rendering of Nixon in the White House, you know, sobbing on his knees, talking about getting a gun in a way that alarmed his aides. This is Woodward and Bernstein's account in the book The Final Days. Nixon resigns in the face of all the evidence of criminality against him. You write, Donald Trump could be looking at an endgame more perilous. That's quite a sentence, you know, something more perilous than Nixon faced. And it has to do with an investigation in New York and payments to Stormy Daniels. Start there. Remind us.
There is actually an ongoing and quite serious criminal probe of President Trump at this moment. It's being conducted by the District Attorney's Office in Manhattan, in New York, and it began by looking into the payments that we all read about during the 2016 campaign where Trump is accused of trying to pay off a porn star to keep her from telling that she had a one-night stand with him that would have been embarrassing for his election. So that was the beginning of the investigation. It has now grown, from what I was able to understand, into quite a serious investigation of his business practices and potential tax fraud, bank fraud, insurance fraud, and they're proceeding ahead.
Yeah. There's his fight with the IRS. And you talk about some of the things we've heard about, the gimmicks he used to eliminate his tax burden, deducting $70,000 for hair care, which is usually a personal expense. I mean, you go into much of this. And by the way, the original complaint that started this, the Stormy Daniels payoff, Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, accused of setting up a shell company that paid out money to Daniels, and that was listed as legal campaign expenses. That's considered an illegal campaign contribution.
I mean, here's the thing. Michael Cohen is cooperating with the Manhattan DA's office. Michael Cohen went to prison for this and had a 3-year sentence. So we've already seen that this is a case that has been brought against somebody else and has succeeded in convicting somebody else. And Trump has been named in all but name as an unindicted co-conspirator of Michael Cohen's in various court documents. He could not be prosecuted in the way the Justice Department viewed it while he was still president. But what the reason that I write about the peril he's in now is if he's no longer president, he can be prosecuted. You know, I'm not trying to say that he will be prosecuted, but I am trying to say it's an actually very serious investigation. And in this case, he can't pardon himself.
Well, let's talk about a pardon. We know that Nixon thought maybe he could pardon himself. His Justice Department and many people close to him said, no, we don't think it works that way. He ended up being pardoned by Gerald Ford. Talk about the fact that, you know, you would think it was written down somewhere whether or not a president can do this, but apparently it's not that clear. Explain.
According to various legal experts, including a Harvard Law professor, Jack Goldsmith, it's really not clear at this point whether a president can pardon himself or not. The powers of the presidential pardon are very broad, and they're not really laid out in any specific way. So all there is this one kind of flimsy, quick Justice Department opinion that came from the Nixon era, where somebody in the Justice Department said that she didn't think a president could pardon himself because no man can stand in, you know, in judgment of his own case. But it really hasn't been tested. Nixon thought about it, but he thought it would disgrace himself if he tried it. Many people think that Trump may try it, including John Meacham, the historian, who said he's always imagined that for a narcissistic president, it might be the perfect final act.
Well, a president can cede power to their vice president, who can then issue a pardon.
And that is also laid out in this Justice Department memo. I mean, it's fascinating. What the memo says is, yes, a president could temporarily cede the power to the vice president, who would then step up to become president, could pardon the temporary former president, who could then come back and take the power again, having been pardoned. And that is laid out in this Justice Department memo. Again, these are uncharted waters. We have not been in this position before. But most people think there are going to be a lot of pardons.
Well, no American president has ever been charged with a criminal offense. So that's kind of where we are. And for those, you know, just tuning in, we're speaking to Jane Mayer of The New Yorker, who is kind of gaming the end game for President Trump if, in fact, he does lose the election and leaves the White House. You know, there are, we should say, Jane, there are a lot of his strong supporters. We've spoken to some of them who believe he will stay. He actually has won the election, so we just want to note that. But you're gaming the end game, but so is apparently everybody in Washington. You spoke to so many Trump associates who, first of all, told you before he lost that he would not admit defeat. Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, said the rush to confirm Amy Coney Barrett was motivated in part because Trump hoped the court would then rule in his favor in election disputes. This rings somewhat true because you think that if he'd held off on pushing her confirmation, he might have won the voters who wanted to ensure that he won so that he could have her confirmed. But then others speculated about whether or not President Trump would leave the country. Is that possible? Can he just do that?
Well, I mean, it seems unfathomable in this country. I mean, you know, obviously we have not seen it before, but it's happened in other countries that have had corrupt oligarchical kinds of leaders. And some of the people who study authoritarianism, Timothy Snyder, professor at Yale, for instance, suggests that it's not out of the question. A number of people who know Trump are watching this, and they know his character well, and they think he can really operate from almost any country where he's got a business set up, and he's got his company is worldwide. So there are those possibilities. But Tony Schwartz, his former co-author of The Art of the Deal, the book that really made Trump famous in the first place, says, where would he go? Who would want him?
He does have followers around the world, and as you said, he does have at least hotels in his name around the world, and not necessarily ones he owns.
He does. I mean, what he's really been talking about most recently now is possibly running for another term in 2024. And that's something that his former political aide, Steve Bannon, had floated. And most people didn't take it too seriously at first, but evidently that is the talk around the White House, which serves a number of purposes. It presents Trump, even if he has to leave the White House this time, as someone who's still viable, still a political power. And people around him say he sees it also as potentially a shield against prosecution because it would look political if someone went after him.
Well, that is if prosecution or indictment or any settling of these investigations has not happened in 4 years. Or it could be that he is not indicted. None of this happens. And there's speculation that he may become a talk show host or a replacement for Rush Limbaugh, who's fighting terminal lung cancer, or a competitor for Fox News. He has not been happy with his coverage by Fox News during the election, for instance, when they called Arizona. What were people saying about that, him starting maybe his own network?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of talk about this. It was something that they talked about seriously, his aides and he, and at the time Roger Ailes, who had just left Fox. They talked about this in 2016 quite seriously, getting him some kind of media platform. And in the story that I've got in The New Yorker, I have a statement from Bernard Marcus, Bernie Marcus, he calls himself, who is one of the co-founders of Home Depot. And he's got the means to really invest in something like that. He's a huge Trump backer, and he thinks it's a great idea. So you've got some of the ingredients that might make it work. Some of the people who've known Trump well are a little skeptical because a talk show, as you know, is a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort to plan a really good show. And someone like Rush Limbaugh has worked very hard at it. Whatever you think of his show, he really has put a lot of effort into it. And people who know Trump say it might be too much work for what he wants to do.
That's Jane Mayer, chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Her article, Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose Gaming the Endgame, is in the most recent New Yorker magazine. We'll link you at herenow.org. Jane, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Drive-in theaters have found a new life as the pandemic keeps people away from traditional movie theaters. Katie Blackley from member station WESA in Pittsburgh reports on how the declining industry is seeing new demand.
So direct your steps to our refreshment stand to enjoy the finest snacks in all the land.
On a chilly October evening, Vicky Potter stands in a gravel parking lot in Pittsburgh's Strip District neighborhood.
We are at Row House Cinema's drive-in for a showing of The Princess Bride.
Masked and surrounded by family and friends, Potter says she was excited to get outside for some entertainment.
We love that movie, so we thought, why not come out? And it's a beautiful night, so let's enjoy a movie.
The 1987 comedy adventure tale with sword fights, monsters, and true love is one of several films Row House has shown at this location as part of its new drive-in movie series. The theater's Kelsey Zamish says the outdoor films are an attempt to stay connected with audiences.
You know, I think there's a huge desire that Pittsburgh has for events like this. I mean, there's just not that much to do right now in environments that you can feel safe.
Like many businesses, Row House is adapting to life during the pandemic. Zamish says in March, when Pennsylvania's shutdown began, staffers immediately started talking about how to stay relevant.
We put together a virtual cinema platform, and not too long after, came up with our Cat Film Fest, so we've been staying busy despite it all.
After a few months, they partnered with developers who own the Strip District lot, bought the necessary equipment, and began selling tickets for outdoor films. While this drive-in space is new, existing drive-in movie theaters throughout the country are using their lands in new ways.
It wasn't probably till the end of March when people started reaching out and saying, would you be interested in a graduation? Would you be interested in running a dance recital? Could we maybe use the premises as church?
That's Beth Manson, co-owner of Starlight Drive-In in Butler County, Pennsylvania, which opened in the 1950s. After some confusion about state-mandated restrictions on businesses, Starlight owners determined they could safely hold a number of outdoor events.
And the calls just keep coming in.
The business was contacted by comedians, musicians, and dancers, all looking for a venue to showcase their talents and make up some of the money they lost during the shutdown. That's important for drive-in survival right now. Carnegie Mellon University Marketing Associate Professor Jeff Gallick says the businesses have been in steady decline for decades.
If you look back at around the 1950s, at the peak of drive-in culture, there were maybe about 4,000 of them in the United States. We're down to somewhere around 300 right now.
The drive-ins that remain open weren't exactly raking it in before the pandemic. Conventional movie theaters closer to home are preferred, and the rise of streaming services kept would-be moviegoers inside. But now that everybody's forced to be inside, Gallick says it's easy to see why people are taking advantage of the opportunity for entertainment.
I think it's a wonderful band-aid to put on the situation of people being stuck at home. I think anything that people can do where they can safely go out and socialize and just feel some sort of common sense of community is a wonderful thing to have right now.
Still, Gallick says long-term, he doesn't anticipate the pandemic-related showings to sustain the drive-in industry.
Nobody wants to drive an hour away every time they want to go see a movie or a comedy show. Those are pretty inconvenient things to do. Today, in pandemic times, people will do that, but they're not going every Friday night.
Especially as the weather cools. Still, Starlight's Beth Manson says she's glad drive-in theaters give people an outlet.
Families have come together. Families have been pushed together whether they want to be or not. We are the one avenue, the one venue, where people are able to drive in, stay in their area, and drive back out. It's fantastic.
For Here and Now, I'm Katie Blackley in Pittsburgh.
Let's get some world reaction to Joe Biden's presidential victory. NPR's Frank Langfitt is in the United Kingdom, and NPR's Lucian Kim in Russia. Hello to you both.
Hi, Peter. Great to be here.
Hello.
And Frank, let's start with you. How is the government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson responding to Joe Biden's victory?
Yeah, well, actually, Boris Johnson just said moments ago that he'd actually talked to Joe Biden and congratulated him on the election and really tried to emphasize things they have in common, things they can work on, like climate change, promoting democracy, and building back better from the pandemic. Now, I got to tell you that this was not the first person in this part of the world that Joe Biden called. He actually spoke to the Prime Minister of Ireland first, which I think is also sending a message. He is Irish of Irish descent, Joe Biden, and also he's very supportive of the EU, which of course Boris Johnson has been at odds with during the whole Brexit saga.
Well, you know what's interesting is that Boris Johnson and President Trump have been somewhat political soulmates over the past few years. They're two very outspoken populists, nationalists as well. You know, what do you think Johnson's relationship with Joe Biden will be like, considering he's so different from President Trump?
Yeah, I think that initially it will be cool. I think that it's not just a personal difference, but also a little bit of a political history here. I don't know whether people will remember this. It's somewhat obscure, but some people in the Biden camp do remember it, that Johnson insulted President Obama back in 2016 when the Churchill bust was moved out of the Oval Office. And I think Boris Johnson said, well, maybe this was because of President Obama's part Kenyan ancestry and that he didn't like the British Empire, that sort of thing. And Biden has called Johnson a physical and emotional clone of Trump, which is not entirely fair. Johnson, a much more dynamic and complex person. But I think, Peter, once they get past Brexit, and it's a tricky period right now, there are going to be opportunities for them to work on things that actually Johnson and Biden are much closer on than Johnson ever was with Trump. And a good example would be working on climate change. Obviously, Biden is going to have the U.S. Rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. And there are going to be these opportunities here next year with the big U.N. climate change conferences in Glasgow, and the United Kingdom is going to be heading the G7. That's the meeting of the seven largest economies in the world. And so there's going to be chances really for Biden and Johnson to get together and work on things that they have in common.
Hmm. Frank Langfitt, hang tight there in the United Kingdom. Let's move on to Russia. Lucian Kim, unlike what's happening in the United Kingdom, the Kremlin has not acknowledged Biden's victory. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, you're right. There hasn't really been much of a reaction here. On Monday, the Kremlin spokesman said President Vladimir Putin would not congratulate Biden until there are official results and President Trump no longer disputes Biden's win. Of course, the timing of when one world leader congratulates another often does have to do with personal sympathy. We see that in the congratulations pouring in from America's traditional allies. And in that sense, Putin very much stands apart.
Yeah. And if you look at some of the history of Joe Biden, he was heavily involved in foreign policy as a senator, but also as President Obama's vice president. What do we know about how he might approach President Putin and Russia when he takes office next year? Is there a fear that he will be much tougher on Russia than Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think it's quite that simple. Biden is certainly a well-known figure here in Moscow. He visited the Soviet Union as a senator and met with Putin when he was vice president. He has always taken a tough stance toward Russia, so little love lost between him and Putin. But what I think is interesting after talking with Russian experts here is that the Kremlin may actually welcome a Biden presidency. Biden is predictable compared to Trump. He represents the American establishment, and there is a feeling in Moscow that he's tough, but someone you can do business with. There's going to be a test of that practically the moment Biden is inaugurated in January, because a few weeks later, the last major arms control agreement between Russia and the U.S. expires, and Biden has said he would extend it. That's very welcome news in the Kremlin.
Yeah, and on the other hand, with Biden winning, what does that do to fears or complaints that Russia interfered in the U.S. election?
Well, that's funny that you ask that, because almost the main reaction here is relief that Russia is not being blamed for interfering in the election this time. So there is a feeling here that since this is no longer the main topic of conversation in the U.S., maybe it will be possible to move ahead on bilateral issues.
Oh, that's interesting. Frank Langfitt in the United Kingdom, let's get back to you. The British political parties, of course, we're such close allies, are watching American politics closely. They always have. Are they drawing any lessons from the election results here?
Well, they're certainly trying to, because it's interesting. The next parliamentary elections here are 2024, which is the same time there's going to be another presidential election in the U.S., and they're fascinated by what they've seen. It's interesting. The conservatives, I think, and analysts here, they look at what happened to Trump, and one of the things they focused on is the fact that he did get 71 million votes. He lost, but his message clearly resonated with a lot of Americans. And I think the way they're interpreting this at the moment is populism does have a place here, but it probably needs to be in sort of with a much less brash kind of person at the front of the campaign and somebody in terms of running in 2024. Labor likes, they're of course the main opposition party. They're sort of the closest equivalent to the Democrats here in the United Kingdom. They like what they see in a Biden win, and that's because Keir Starmer is like Biden. Keir Starmer runs the Labor Party right now. He's a centrist. He's very solid. He's very competent. And even though people would say he doesn't have the kind of charisma of a Clinton, Obama, or even Tony Blair, the former prime minister, Labor prime minister here, that they see that they might be able to, maybe in 2024, do much better, maybe even be able to take number 10 Downing Street. I was talking to a guy named Andrew Adonis. He's with the Labor Party. He's a peer in the Britain's House of Lords, and this is how he put it.
If the American Democrats can win with Biden, then I think that offers very great hope about the triumph of anti-populism against populism, even if it doesn't have a Tony Blair at its head.
Oh, well, that's so interesting. So that's the political view, Frank. But what about, I want to ask you both this question. What do the people think? You know, what do the British people and the Russian people think about this election? Have they been watching closely? Frank, why don't you start?
Yeah, I mean, the British people don't like Donald Trump. For obvious reasons, political reasons, as well as personal reasons, he would be sort of the epitome from their perspective of the ugly American. And if you look at polls here, it's like at least 75% don't like him. When the votes were tallied, I guess I was in London the next day, and the feeling was they were glad to see him go, but they were disappointed that it had not been a big rebuke, like it had not been a blue wave. And the reason they wanted that is because they wanted to kind of see some evidence that American democracy was really righting itself from their perspective. And it really gave them pause. I think the last 4 years have really shaken confidence here, not just in the United Kingdom, but in other parts of Europe, about the American democratic system. And the lack of sort of a resounding defeat almost compounded that among people that I was talking to in London.
Yeah. Lucien, what's the view from Russia?
Well, I think the main sense here is Russians' lack of interest in this election, which might sound surprising to you. A poll that was taken right before the U.S. election found that 45% of respondents were not paying any attention to the election.
Wow.
Perhaps even more interesting is that almost half of respondents said they were hearing about Joe Biden for the very first time. That tells you a little bit about the level of interest. The explanation for that, according to analysts, is that there is no expectation for relations to improve. And there's a widespread feeling here that the U.S. is out to get Russia, so it doesn't make a difference who's president.
That's NPR's Lucian Kim in Moscow and NPR's Frank Langfitt just outside of London. Thank you very much to both of you.
Happy to do it.
And we want to take a moment here to acknowledge the death of one of the world's most prominent advocates for Palestinian statehood, Sahib Erekat. Erekat tested positive for COVID-19 in October. He died Tuesday after suffering multiple organ failure. Erekat played a key role in the decades-long peace negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis, and his enduring goal was to achieve a two-state solution. Here he is talking about it with CNN back in February.
We must have a negotiated solution between us and the Israelis. And if we don't help ourselves, as Israelis and Palestinians, that means this will be translated in the blood of my children and their children. And nobody else will do it for us.
His vision became harder to realize after President Trump was elected and the White House prioritized Israel in its peace plan for the Middle East. Sahib Erekat was 65.
Today, European regulators announced new antitrust charges against Amazon, accusing the company of unfairly using data to gain an advantage over smaller merchants on its platform. Amazon denies the charges. In the U.S., it's been an unprecedented time of scrutiny for tech companies, and it's unclear what a Biden presidency will mean for tech regulation. Let's bring in Peter Kafka, senior correspondent for Recode. Peter, lots at stake for tech companies right now. The Department of Justice, under the Trump administration, recently filed a lawsuit against Google, and we've reported on possible legal action against Facebook. What do you think happens to those?
I think all the things, and we're gonna do some informed speculation slash guesswork here, but I think all the things that are sort of in motion right now will continue to go in motion. First of all, there's a couple months left in the Trump presidency. And even after Joe Biden assumes the presidency, I think he'd be loath to sort of call a halt to sort of any moving investigation or charges. When you see a Biden administration come in and immediately say, let's stop scrutinizing Silicon Valley, it'll send the wrong message. Sure. And I think there, regardless of what actually happens, there will at least be political pressure to continue acting to rein in the big tech companies.
Well, and your reference was maybe to the fact that the Obama-Biden administration was seen as friendly to big tech. And those were the years when companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google grew into what the House Judiciary Committee recently likened in their big antitrust report to the oil tycoons. So, you know, you had the Biden then kind of cozying up to big tech. What about Biden now? Because while the Trump administration might be, you know, increasingly hostile to Twitter, for instance, which has been flagging the president's tweets, you know, others are angry at the platforms who can't seem to stop Russian interference or the growth of right-wing militias. Where do you see Biden now?
It's a mixed bag. And again, we'll see more over the next couple of months as we see who he appoints into key roles in the government. But Joe Biden didn't spend a lot of time campaigning about tech or antitrust issues. That said, his campaign complained quite often about Facebook in particular and sort of the ads they did and didn't allow. Joe Biden told the New York Times that he wanted to repeal Section 230, the business and legal philosophy that allows the big tech companies to sort of operate the way they do now. On the other hand, Kamala Harris, his vice president, is very tight with most of Silicon Valley. She comes from there. They know her. She's not been someone who's been overly critical of tech in the past. And you've also got a whole bunch of people who were in the Obama administration who now have crucial jobs in the tech industry. For instance, Jay Carney, who was spokesman for Obama, now has a key role at Amazon. So they're still quite intertwined. They certainly know each other. It's not like the Trump administration where Donald Trump really had no outreach to Silicon Valley and was approaching them from a sort of completely outside perspective.
Yeah. Well, but you mentioned she's from there, meaning California. California just passed Prop 24. How does that impact this? Remind us what that is.
Prop 24, and you won't know these names if you don't live in California, and even if you are in California, you may not. It's a long acronym, but basically it's a new, improved version of a privacy law California already passed 2 years ago. This one is supposed to sort of plug some loopholes in. And because most internet companies are based in Silicon Valley and or do business in California, most essentially of the internet in the U.S. is going to sort of effectively be ruled by this proposition that Californians just passed, which is supposed to overall increase their privacy. So that will be important regardless of what the federal government does.
Well, the federal government last year did get close to passing a major federal data privacy bill. It was called the U.S. Consumer Data Privacy Act. There were hearings, you know, on repealing Section 230, what you were just talking about. But you're saying that now it's probably going to come from the ground up?
This has sort of been one of the complaints the tech companies have had. They said, we want a federal law. We don't want to have to worry about 50 different state privacy laws. I don't think that there was ever any real chance that Congress, under its existing makeup, was going to pass significant overhauls of Section 230. And I think it's maybe even less likely in the next 2 years if you're looking at split government. One, because I think the Biden administration may have other priorities than reforming tech. Mm-hmm. And two, because consistently you've had both Republicans and Democrats saying they want to change this law, 230, but for very different reasons. And the reasons seem so opposed to me that it's like they're talking past each other. And it's hard to imagine them reaching bipartisan agreement.
Well, you just indicated the Biden administration has a few other things on its mind. And, you know, the idea of, you know, antitrust, that may go on the back burner. But what are you hearing from Silicon Valley? I mean, how are they preparing for the next administration?
They know they're not getting a free pass. They know they're not going back to the Obama administration. They know there will be continued scrutiny. That said, you know, it's not Donald Trump. It's someone they can speak to. It's someone they understand how to work with, or at least they think they do. You've seen a couple of the Silicon Valley leaders reach out to Joe Biden immediately this weekend and congratulate him. Jeff Bezos was one of those at Amazon. And everyone else, you know, has figured out how to work with Donald Trump. And one of the things they've figured out is you don't go ahead and proactively anger Donald Trump, which is why I think you won't see people like Tim Cook dancing in the streets with the rest of California after the election. But I think they are all quietly relieved that there is someone in the White House that they can do business with.
Peter Kafka, senior correspondent for Recode, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.